It is a pleasure to be here. Welcome to the Cambridge Forum. My name is Lonnie Guinier. I'm a professor at Harvard Law School, and I'm here to speak with Kenji Yoshino about his new book covering the hidden assault on our civil rights. Author Kenji Yoshino argues for a new way of thinking about civil rights at what he calls a transitional moment in how America discriminates. Why do we let the pressures of our society force us to cover, to tone down an aspect of our personality so that we can fit into the mainstream? In a culture that often unfairly demands conformity, how can we present our authentic selves? How can we create an authentically diverse society? Yoshino articulates the limits of what the law and identity politics can do to protect civil rights, fusing rigorous legal analysis with a deep appreciation of his own experience as a gay Asian American. He follows the romantics in his belief that if a human life is described with enough particularity, the universal will speak through it. The resulting transcendent vision of civil rights focuses on the freedoms that draw Americans together. Kenji Yoshino is a professor of law and deputy dean for intellectual life at Yale Law School. He's a specialist in constitutional law, anti-discrimination law, law and literature, and he has published in both legal and general interest journals, including the Boston Globe, The Nation, The New York Times, and The Village Voice. He has appeared on The Charlie Rose Show and The O'Reilly Factor. Welcome to Cambridge Forum, Kenji Yoshino.
Thank you so much to the Cambridge Forum and to the Harvard Bookstore for co-sponsoring this event. And thank you so much to you all for coming here. And thank you especially to Professor Guinier, who, since my student days, has been an enormous role model for me. And I'm incredibly touched that you're willing to moderate this discussion. So I really want to keep this presentation part short because One of the arguments of the book is the importance of dialogue, so I'd much rather have conversation with you than to be speaking at you. So I'll really try and keep this as brief as I possibly can while giving the guts of my argument to those of you who are not familiar with it. My book is called Covering the Hidden Assault on Our Civil Rights, and that, of course, raises at least two inaugural questions. One is, what is covering? And the other one is, why do I think that it is a hidden assault on our civil rights? Well, covering is the sociologist Irving Goffman's term for how we downplay known stigmatized aspects of our identity. It's often confused with passing, so I want to start out by distinguishing the two terms. Passing differs from covering because when individuals pass, no one knows that they even hold the stigmatized identity. Whereas with covering, the stigmatized identity is known, but nonetheless the individual makes a great effort to downplay it so that other people can ignore it. Goffman has this wonderful example to distinguish the two terms when he talks about President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And he says, President Roosevelt used to always ensure that he was sitting behind a desk before his cabinet entered. Now, of course, Roosevelt wasn't passing because everybody in his cabinet knew that he was disabled and in a wheelchair. But he was covering because what he wanted to do was to make sure that his more conventionally presidential qualities were at the forefront of the interaction and that his disability was in the background. Once we start thinking about covering in this way, we begin to realize that there's not a single person in this room who has not covered. This is because in our increasingly diverse society, the idea of the mainstream is a myth. All of us are outside of the mainstream in some way because the mainstream is not a monolithic entity, but rather a shifting coalition of groups. So, as the queer theorists are fond of saying, it is not normal to be completely normal. All of us have covered selves, and all of us have experienced the pressure for conformity, often at great personal cost. So that's what covering is. Why do I think that covering is the hidden assault on our civil rights? Well, as Lonnie was saying, I think that we are now at an immensely important transitional moment in the way that Americans discriminate. In the first generation of discrimination, it was very easy to detect animus against particular groups because the assault on our civil rights was not hidden at all. It took the form of categorical exclusion, namely, no racial minorities, no women, no gays, no individuals with disabilities, no religious minorities allowed. These prohibitions were categorical and they were explicit. And it took the immeasurable suffering and struggle of the modern civil rights movement to disestablish these forms of categorical exclusion. And here I'm thinking of things like the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and also more recently the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990. But human cussedness being what it is, we shouldn't expect this kind of animus simply to evaporate because we've passed a law or two to disestablish such forms of discrimination. So now the discrimination has simply morphed into a new and more subtle form, and this is the form that I'm calling the hidden assault on our civil rights. So what is this form? The new form of discrimination, I want to argue, no longer targets groups as a whole, but rather targets the subset of the group that refuses or is unable to assimilate to mainstream norms. So to cash that out in practical terms, the idea is that racial minorities are pressured to cover by acting white, or they suffer the consequences. Women are pressured at work to, quote unquote, play like men or to downplay their childcare responsibilities to help other workers forget that they are women. Gays might be accepted in the workplace or they might not, but they certainly risk rejection more if they, quote unquote, flaunt their gayness by not being straight acting in their demeanor or by engaging in public displays of same-sex affection. Religionists will be sanctioned if they show any kind of pride or identification with their religious identity, as we've seen when Muslim women refused to drop their veils or their Arabic after 9/11. And finally, as in the FDR example, the disabled are also much more likely to be stigmatized if they don't hide or tone down the very paraphernalia that permit them to function in society. So what I'm calling the hidden assault on our civil rights is the demand that outsiders cover if they want to be included. Now, where is the law on this? I'm a specialist in anti-discrimination law and constitutional law. So my immediate response when I was thinking about the covering demand was to look to the law for remedies. Unfortunately, current American anti-discrimination law does not generally cognize covering demands as a harm. The reason for this is that American anti-discrimination law generally, not uniformly, but generally protects the immutable aspects of identity, but not the mutable aspects of identity. Or put differently, it protects the things that we can't change about ourselves rather than the things that we can. So if a woman gets fired by an employer because of her skin color, I want to be that woman's lawyer, because she will win her lawsuit in a hot second on the basis of race discrimination. But if that same woman gets fired by the employer for wearing cornrows or engaging in other cultural practices that are associated with her race, then she will have a much harder time succeeding, as actual cases on the books show. Similarly, if a woman gets fired simply for being a woman, having 2X chromosomes, she will generally prevail in her lawsuit. But if a woman gets fired for acting too, quote unquote, feminine on the job, or if she gets fired for being a mother, the outcome of her case will be much less clear. And if a gay person gets fired simply for being gay, at least in some jurisdictions, the gay plaintiff will prevail. But again, as we see in the case law, if the gay person gets fired for flaunting by, for example, having a same-sex commitment ceremony, even if that same-sex commitment ceremony is private and religious, he will not be able to prevail in court, as a 1998 case demonstrates. So what we're seeing is that the law needs to be reformed in order to redress this new generation of discrimination, but it hasn't gotten there yet. And the legal part of my project is to say that both our equality law and our liberty law, you know, our freedom to be who we are, our freedoms of self-expression and of speech, need to be reformed in order to protect people from such unreasoning and subordinating forms of discrimination. However, what I really want to talk to you about tonight is how increasingly I've had the sense that covering demands are best redressed culturally rather than legally, and that in this new generation of civil rights, we have to rely on all of us in our capacity as citizens to do the work of equality rather than relying simply on the subset of us who are lawyers. And I think that for at least two reasons. First of all, the number of groups that the law is willing to protect is very limited, and there's enormous compassion fatigue in this country for adding new groups to the list of legally protected groups. And so at some point, the Supreme Court's largesse or sympathy for different identity politics groups is going to run out if it hasn't already. Second, even if we were able to reform the law in that way, many covering demands are made by people that the law does not, and in my view, actually should not hold accountable under the law. So the law generally holds accountable the state or the employer, and I, of course, believe that those entities should be held accountable. But oftentimes, covering demands are much more fine-grained and intimate than that. So when we're pressured to conform, it's often by our peers, you know, in a form of peer pressure, or by our families, or often by our own censorious consciousnesses. So oftentimes when I'm trying to figure out why I'm experiencing pressure to cover, the only actor I can trace the covering demand back to is myself. And while I'm often tempted to sue myself, I recognize that this is probably not my healthiest impulse. So what I'm trying to articulate to you tonight is to urge you to think about civil rights as a project in which we all have a stake and in which we all have a responsibility. And not to just say this in a kind of chastising or even hortatory way to you, but also to say it in a hopeful and in an exciting way. Because I think that once we move beyond the law, civil rights suddenly becomes a much more universal and expansive enterprise. So whenever I give these talks about covering, I've come to expect a response, which I've come to call in my mind the angry straight white man response, because someone in the audience, usually a white man and usually angry, will say, well, why shouldn't racial minorities or women or gays have to cover? I can understand why they should be protected for things they can't change, like skin color or chromosomes or maybe even innate sexual desires, but I don't understand why they should be protected in the ability to express their authentic selves, because I have to cover all the time. I have to cover my depression, or I have to cover my schizophrenia, or I have to cover the fact that I'm a working class person with a working class background, or I have to cover the fact that I'm illiterate, or I have to cover the fact that I'm an artist. So why should these traditional civil rights groups get the right of self-expression, either under the law or in our culture, when I too am one of the mass of men leading a life of quiet desperation? Why shouldn't my desire for authenticity count too? And I always surprise these people when I agree with them, because I think that once we move outside of the law and think about civil rights as a cultural project, we see the revolutionary breadth of the aspiration of civil rights. And that revolutionary aspiration is that each and every one of us has an authentic self that deserves some kind of purchase and expression in the public sphere, so long as it doesn't end up harming another human being. And when we think about civil rights as that broader project of human flourishing, then it becomes a project not about particular victimized special interest groups, but rather a universal project of human flourishing in which each and every one of us has a stake. So I want to conclude now, before I open it up to the conversation that I promised, by reading to you from the epilogue of my book. One of the things that was most, well, frankly, scary for me about writing this book is that until I wrote this book, I was a very buttoned-down law professor, and everything I wrote was, you know, written in these immensely boring and impersonal tones, and my tenure piece had 900 footnotes, and, you know, I think I got tenure because I bored my colleagues to death. But what I wanted to do in this book is to show that I had the courage of my convictions, because it struck me that I couldn't write a book about authenticity without risking some authenticity of my own. And what was really funny to me about the book was that I thought the things that I would be most nervous about exposing were coming to a gay identity or writing about my own racial identity in the kind of canonical civil rights categories. But it turned out that what I was most trepidatious about was writing, or feeling exposed as a writer, actually, because I was kind of a poet manqué. I studied poetry as an undergraduate and left poetry and literature in order to go to law school. For a variety of reasons that I talk about a bit in my book. And where I felt kind of most exposed, most naked, most uncovered, so to speak, in this book, was in the aspiration to write in a voice that performed the thesis of the book, which is that the traditional civil rights categories are not the only ways in which we can feel suppressed as human beings. So I only have time to read you a few paragraphs, but I want to read you the last four paragraphs or five paragraphs of the book. And the only setup that you need to know is that I am writing about attending the wedding of the woman with whom I had a relationship with in college. Because I know where to look, I can see the blue star even across the crowded ballroom. It smolders at the tip of Janet's left shoulder blade above the wedding gown. It looks entirely of her body, at this distance, like a birthmark. Only at a conversational closeness will its strict geometry reveal it to be a tattoo. At 30, Janet quips the tattoo is the best investment she has ever made. As this day approached, her conservative Korean parents offered her escalating sums of money to have it removed, or at least to hide it. But here it is, blue star on brown skin, beneath bands of black hair, and white gown, like a painting of Bethlehem after Rothko. As I watch her, a ripple passes over her back, meaning she is laughing. She grasps the hand of one of the aunts in Hanbuk, who has flown in from Korea for the occasion. Janet's voice is wry and authoritative, surprisingly deep for her small, fine-boned body. So while she laughs frequently, her laughter still feels like something bestowed. At the reception that has just ended, her maid of honor broke down in tears as she gave her speech. Janet hugged her with a tearless laugh. Why did this gesture, which would have seemed brusque in another, stir such warmth in me when made by her? As she started medical school, Janet got the tattoo. She chose the blue star of a Philip Levine poem, in which the star appears on a man's chest, tiny and perfect. The man is a working man who makes the glare for light bulbs, desirous of normalcy. He wants none of it. But after the surgeon cuts it off, he announces to his patient that underneath it is another perfect blue star. Presumably, underneath that, another. Janet and I fought over the tattoo. I told her she had misconstrued the nature of time. In 30 years, I said, she would be an entirely different person, but the tattoo would still be there to embarrass her. Who was she, at 24, to bind that future self? Janet responded that I was the one who had misconstrued time. She agreed that over the next years, she would change, that she would have to change. Yet she said that if her future self was embarrassed by the star, she wanted it to be embarrassed. She was entering a time in her life when her commitment to poetry would become more endangered than ever. And she wanted to protect that commitment by writing it on her body. If she became a doctor who stopped reading and writing poetry, she wanted to hear the reproach of this younger self. My mistake, she said, was that I assumed people got wiser as they got older. So the star is still here on her wedding day. I still dislike tattoos, except for this one, which I love out of mind. Thank you.
So, is this on? I hope that especially the reading of the last several paragraphs encourages all of you to buy this book, because it is absolutely beautifully written and evocative of so much depth of emotion and expanse of thinking. But I want to mention one moment in the book that is reported also in the New York Times Review, when Kenji is having a conversation with his mom, and she says to him in Japanese, you know, your problem is you think too much. Life is not that simple. I just love that line. And so my question, Kenji, in terms of thinking about what some psychologists call optimal distinctiveness, that is, the space between where one is an individual and distinctive versus one is a member of a group and conformist. Where is that space for you? You're talking about trying to find or to preserve the authentic self in the public sphere, but you're also talking about a conversation in which you have to negotiate culturally the means by which each of us is permitted to retain or to perform our authentic self. But what demands does that then make on the group, the conformist, for accommodating all of these multiple authentic selves that are each challenging our capacity to make a decision or to move forward?
Great. That's a terrific question. I mean, first I have to give props to my mom there, because when she said life is not that simple, I remember having this kind of huge upwelling of kind of love for her, because it struck me that most parents would say to their kids, don't think so hard, life is not that complicated, rather than don't think so hard, life is not that simple. You know, so I really appreciated that from her, and thanks for picking up on that. But I mean, the question that you ask is a really profound one, and I think that the immediate answer I want to give here is that my commitment is primarily to autonomy as a means of finding authenticity, right? And what I mean by that is that I'm not starting with any a priori concept of what an authentic self, either mine or anyone else's, is. I don't think that we come into the world fully formed with an authentic self that yearns for expression over, you know, and that someday we like have the courage to pull the drape off of that self and there it is. I rather think of the authentic self as something that we grow much more organically, and that it's a work in progress, and I find myself, you know, working and changing on the ways in which I express myself and surprising myself in all of these different ways. You know, if I can kind of indulge in an anecdote, actually, a friend of mine was visiting out in Arizona for a semester and was hanging out. This is a woman who had always considered herself to be a heterosexual woman, and she was hanging out with a friend of hers who happened to be a lesbian, and they were spending a lot of time together. And she lived in a house that she was renting, and across the way from her was this beautiful house with, I think they're called tangelos, those kind of orangey-looking things, the tangerine thingies. And the tangelo tree was kind of creeping over the fence and kind of muddying the air with its ruddy waves of scent, and was beckoning to her every time she would walk by it. And she would just ignore it because she had work to do and she was teaching, et cetera, et cetera. And then finally, after the semester of hanging out with her lesbian friend, she sort of walked by the tangelo tree. Classes were over, she had time, and finally she responded to the invitation of the tree and went right up to it and looked at it and was enveloped by its scent. And she looked up at the tangelo tree and she noticed two things simultaneously. First of all, that the tangelos looked exactly like breasts, and second of all, that she was in love with her colleague at the school. And what would life be? How terrible life would be if we came into life thinking that we had this authentic self that was rigid and for all time, because that would prevent us from these moments of, you know, these kind of sweet modalities of shock and surprise where we suddenly discover that we're not who we are, or, you know, anymore, or that we're now a completely different kind of being. So I know this is a very circuitous answer to the question, but what I'm trying to point out here is that what I'm calling the authentic self is not a fixed, rigid entity that is given to us and remains stable over time. It's something that's constantly shifting. And so if we really want to honor that authenticity, what we really have to honor is the freedom and the autonomy to actually make the choices that bring us closer to whatever that self would be in a particular moment. Now, to more directly engage with your question, Lani, I mean, if I were to cast this out in more concrete terms, because oftentimes I think these debates are more fruitfully had at the most concrete level possible, one way of thinking about this is to say, oftentimes individuals find themselves caught between two communities, right? So, you know, oftentimes covering demands are made by the dominant community, so racial minorities are encouraged to act white. But then the minority community itself makes exactly the opposite demand, what I call in my book the reverse covering demand. So if I'm an Asian American and I go to Phillips Exeter, like the dominant, you know, impetus or pressure on me is going to be to act white and not to join the Asian group and to run for student government instead and to, you know, ace all my English classes and not take too many math classes because that will just fulfill the stereotype of, you know, the Asian math whiz. I mean, honestly, I mean, there's nothing more boring than being good at math as an Asian these days, you know, and that when I was in these classes, I would ace these tests and the professor or the teacher would just kind of, you know, roll his eyes, but it was the English teachers whose eyes would widen when I wrote a good sentence or said something about a poem. So I was like, okay, I'll be an English major, you know, who wants to be a stereotype, who wants to live in a box, you know. But of course, right, I mean, if we just live our lives inverting stereotypes about our group, we're just as controlled by those stereotypes as a photograph is controlled by its negative, right? If we just reverse every single term of the stereotype, then we're still controlled by the stereotype. And I think that's what you're getting at, Lani, because oftentimes people are caught within the crosshairs of competing demands. So again, in my example, the white group is asking the Asian American to assimilate to white norms. Then the Asian group comes back and says, well, you're self-hating, you know, you're a banana, you know, are yellow on the outside but white on the inside, and we want to police you back into solidarity with Asians, and why aren't you coming to the Asian group, and et cetera, et cetera. So at that point, you can't win if you go in with a fixed idea of what it means to be an authentic Asian American. The only way in which you can actually flourish in that environment is to understand yourself as having maximal freedom to choose among whatever options are available to you, and to ask others to also give you that freedom, and to say, well, maybe, you know, the fact that I choose to, you know, major in English or focus on English classes is in part because, you know, it's old hat to be a math major as an Asian American. But maybe it also has to do with something that has nothing to do with my Asian American identity, such as the fact that, you know, I was a voracious reader of poetry and Greek mythology and anything I could get my hands on when I was a kid. So none of us wants to live in a box, right, on the one hand. So that's one truth. The other truth is that we can't sort of create ourselves ab initio. Like, we can't just formulate ourselves all on our own. We're all social creatures. So we can only use the materials that are around us, and many of those materials are shot through with stereotypes. So in order to balance those two things, I think that we have to recognize that we're not creating ourselves anew, that we only have the social materials that are available to us, but that what we can ask is that of ourselves and of those around us is to give us the maximal freedom to use those social materials such that we can formulate something that looks cognizably like an individual life.
So I'd like to open the conversation to some of the members of the audience. This is the Cambridge Forum, and we are talking with Kenji Yoshino, who is the author of Covering. Could you state your name?
My name is Sanford Ostroy. I wondered if you could comment, since you're a law professor, how we're going to change things in the United States when members of the Supreme Court are willing to make in written statements, statements that are discriminatory and use terms that are often against certain groups.
What are you thinking of, sir?
Well, Scalia's written comments, I don't remember the specific case, but he used some racial anti-gay terms mm-hmm. in one of his written comments, mm-hmm. written mm-hmm. statements.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, clearly this is not a happy time for civil rights in this country, and that is probably the understatement of the year. So let me start by acknowledging that, right? But I do want to say that, and you should also know that with respect to most issues, I'm a kind of a perennial optimist, so you should leaven whatever I say with a grain of salt. But here's where I see optimism, even with the court that we have today. I think that the current Supreme Court is very, very, very opposed to more group-based equality protections. So I don't think, so currently under constitutional law, the Supreme Court will protect five classifications: race, national origin, alienage, sex, and illegitimacy. And those five classifications get a special form of protection under the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution, which is the home of the equality guarantee. Those five groups are the only groups, and the last of those five groups was anointed in 1977. So the canon seems to have closed on the groups to which the Supreme Court will extend formal protection. Right? Now, if there are lawyers in the audience, there are various ways of kind of scalloping the edges of that statement, but I will nonetheless stand by that as a broad truth about the court. So even as an optimist, I'm not excited about what the court is going to do with respect to group-based equality rights. But what I am optimistic about is that there's a really interesting way in which, even as the Supreme Court is closing one equality door after another, it's actually leaving some liberty doors open, or even opening them wider. So let me give you two examples. One was the 2003 Lawrence versus Texas case, where the Supreme Court struck down a Texas sodomy statute. And the case came to the Supreme Court really as a gay rights case, you know, because the two individuals in question who had violated the sodomy statute were two men, and the sodomy statute didn't actually prescribe cross-sex sodomy. So if it had been a man and a woman, this case wouldn't have even have made it to district court, much less to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ultimately struck down the statute, but it didn't strike down the statute on the basis of the fact that it violated the equality rights of gays. It rather struck down the statute saying that it violated our liberty rights as Americans to engage in sexual intimacy. So rather than framing it as an equality case, it framed it as a liberty case, focusing on liberties that draw us together as Americans, rather than equality rhetoric, which I think ultimately always has the effect of balkanizing us. And notice that the person who wrote the majority opinion in that case, Justice Kennedy, was a Reagan appointee. So even justices who are deemed to be conservative at the time of appointment can actually make these progressive moves. But I think that we'll much more likely see those progressive moves under the liberty analysis, under the equality analysis. Very, very briefly, I promised two examples. The other example is the Tennessee versus Lane case in 2004. This case concerned whether or not Congress could require the states to make their courthouses wheelchair accessible. Again, the court ruled in favor of the minority plaintiffs, but it didn't do so on the basis of group-based equality claims. It didn't say you have the right to have a ramp built because you're disabled. Rather, it said all of us, as Americans, have a fundamental right to access the court. And if you need a ramp to avail yourself of that right, then we'll build the ramp. But it didn't do so treating the right as the special perquisite of a particular minority group, namely the disabled, but rather adverted to a higher level of generality and said, this is a right that all of us as Americans need to have in order to live in a civil society.
If I can get up here, I want to thank both of you for this marvelous presentation. It's just wonderful. It's one of the great things. Professor Guinier, you ask a very deep question about how does one put together the marrying of the wider we belong to the human race than we belong to our particular part of the human race, individual. And what I want to say, I'll risk it. There is the human, the critical mind, of the faculty of that which we bring into criticism and when you take a piece, exegesis, the reasoning. But there's something else that enters in into the writing. And whatever that else is, this question, how do we achieve it? As the great poets of the world are the ones who have been kissed by a force, it's mysterious, who know how to take the factis, the information to be in history, and express it in such a way that we get an idea there's something wider going on. That's the kiss, that's the miraculous kiss, and the best writing and the best presentation. You have that, you have two things going together, and the question, how does one achieve that? That's kind of a mystery. You're kissed by heaven and you express it in such a way that it suggests all of the other. So tonight, all of that happened here tonight, and I thank all of you. And an element here, if I may use it, of beauty. In a mysterious, wonderful way. Not only the thing, but you're both very beautiful people. And the reason I can say it, because I'm the Beast, who always recognizes beauty.
Thank you, Brother Blue. Okay. We have another question. Please come to the microphone. This is the Cambridge Forum, and we are listening to Kenji Yoshino discussing covering the hidden assault on our civil rights.
Lonnie, can I just kibitz on Brother Blue's comment?
Yes.
I just want to thank you so much. That's such a lovely thing to say. But the way in which I've always framed it in my mind is the poet Shelley once said in his defense of poetry, poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. And then George Oppen later revised that, and he said, no, you're wrong. Poets are not the unacknowledged legislators of the world. They are the legislators of the unacknowledged world, right? Which I thought was really deep. But when I went to law school, I was like, I actually want to be an acknowledged legislator of an acknowledged world. So what you're sensing here is a form of you're nice enough to say beautiful, but I think the narcissism on my part is a little ugly. So I have to temper your praise with that. Please.
Hi, I'm Jerry Saunders, and for the sake of argument, is not covering a kind of authenticity in as much as you can choose it? Just an opinion, your thought.
Great. Very pithy and powerful comment. So one of the things that I argue at much greater length in the book is to say that I'm actually neither for nor against covering per se. What I'm against is the demand that individuals cover. So one way to look at this, again, to take a concrete example, is to think about a colleague of mine who just ripped into me when I made this argument, because she said, okay, I'm a woman, you know, I in many ways am kind of male identified, you know, like I was a jock in high school, like I like tinkering around with bikes and motorcycles and things like that. And she was like, it's really offensive to me when you introduce the covering concept as something that's innately bad, because if I actually am fixing my bike and somebody walks by and says, oh, you know, there's Carol, she's covering again, trying to fit in and act male so that she'll be respected by her Yale Law School colleagues. She was like, that's insulting to me because I'm not actually fixing my bike because I want to fit in with my male colleagues. I'm fixing my bike because it's broken, you know? And so we have to actually allow, again, the people the freedom to choose whether to cover or not, or even to whether or not they would accept the label covering for what they're doing, which in this case she wouldn't. So it gets even more complex than what your question suggests. What I think really helps is when we shift the lens away from covering performances and move it to covering demands. I don't like focusing on covering performances because, again, it puts the onus on the outsider individual to justify their own behavior, and that's what, you know, that's where civil rights has always failed, right? It's always required the racial minority or the gay person to justify his behavior rather than asking the bigot to justify theirs, right? So the way in which I want to shift the lens in an analogous way for my analysis is not to focus on covering performances, but rather on covering demands. So when an employer says, thou shalt not wear cornrows to work, or thou shalt not lapse into your native language in an English-only workplace, or thou shalt not be a mother if you want to make partner in this law firm, I'm quite comfortable in saying that those are civil rights issues that are not ambiguous at all. So once we move away from the performance by the individual to the demand made by the employer or the state, then the ambiguity evanesces, or at least it doesn't disappear, but it's greatly clarified, at least in my mind.
Good evening. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
And I think I understand all the things you were talking about very deeply. My name is Eli Arden. It's obviously a Hebrew name, but I was born in Philadelphia a very long time ago. I am a Jew. As a Jew, I am a member of a section of an ethnic group that ever since the Enlightenment has been dealing with issues of covering and not covering, and especially in the United States. For some reason or another, no one is willing to acknowledge my ethnic identity. I am told by the Census Bureau that I am a member of a religious group. Pennsylvania Dutch can be counted as an ethnic group, independently of the fact that they are Mennonite. Assyrians can be counted as an ethnic group, independently of the fact that they are all members of mostly Nestorian, remnants of Nestorian Christianity, which is part of their identity. It doesn't work. It doesn't work very simply because Talmudic religion asserts that the Jews are an ethnos, they are a people. Why is the Census Bureau incapable of acknowledging my identity, which is an aspect of my autonomous self?
Yeah, I mean, that's, I'm afraid, a deeper question than I can answer. No, I think it's actually, but it actually does touch on something that I'm thinking about. So can I riff off of it in the hope that I'll be helpful to you? Okay. Because I think that one of the things that's really fascinating about the way in which anti-discrimination law is heading is that there's a clear division between what I'll call treatment cases and what I'll call formation cases. And treatment cases are, you know, everyone agrees that you're Jewish or everyone agrees that you're African American. And the only question for the court is, have you been treated fairly on the basis of that identity that everybody stipulates is your identity, including you, right? However, there are a separate set of cases which are not treatment cases but which are formation cases where the very question before the court is, what identity are you? And those cases are incredibly fascinating to me, and they date back to at least the race determination trials in the antebellum South, where whether you were a slave or not depended on whether or not you were deemed to be an African American or not. So there would literally be trials as to whether or not person X was African American or white, and a jury would get together and consider things like, did they dress white? Did they talk white? Did they associate with whites? Did they dance nicely? Did they go to the right churches? That kind of thing. And then vote, you know, is this person white or not? Professor of law, Ariella Gross, has done amazing work on this. The modern version that we have of those formation trials is the United States Census. So if you look at the census gives us certain categories that we have to fit or create permutations of. So even though now, since 1980, they've handed the pencil over to us, so it's not a census taker telling us who you are, you can choose. But the choices that you can choose among are so constrained that even if we think about permutations, like you can check off one of 63 permutations in the multiracial category, there's still an enormous dilemma that's placed on individuals as to whether or not the categories are adequate. So one of the most interesting ways of litigation, which as you can predict, the courts have been spectacularly unsympathetic to, is a paucity of characterization itself, or is even the fact that the state is categorizing us in particular ways and forcing certain permutations upon us itself an equal protection violation? And the courts are totally unsympathetic, but I just want to say that there are people out there who share your concern that the state is interpolating them as a certain kind of human being without their being able to choose, right, among a broader panoply of options that make more cultural sense to them.
Hi, Professor.
I'm not sure.
My name is Chris. A few minutes ago, you said that you're against demands against covering. And then a few weeks ago, in the article that you wrote for the New York Times, you said that there's some exceptions to that rule, where there are legitimate interests of the state, of the workplace, of the family, of the ethnic group, where you have to enforce people to cover.
Right.
So to use an easy example, you give nudists, can't walk around naked, it just mm-hmm. doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
How do we have that discussion, or where does the state have a legitimate interest in restricting people's expression, and how do you draw that line?
Great, again, a wonderful question. I mean, the way in which I'm trying to answer that is through the idea of the reason-forcing conversation, right? So currently, the way in which the law is structured is that the presumption is, if you can assimilate, you must. And so if the state or the employer wants you to assimilate, the state or the employer is not required to disgorge a reason for why it wants you to do that. So the reason could be really nefarious, like racism, or it could be, you know, not nefarious but unpersuasive, like workplace harmony or neatness or something like that. You know, we can differ as to whether or not we think those are strong values or not. I tend to always side with individual autonomy rather than values like that. But what you're pointing out is to say that even I believe that some demands for conformity are acceptable. And of course, I have to say that because I'd be a crazy person if I didn't, right? Because assimilation is a precondition of civilization. To wear clothes, to speak a language, to have manners, to obey the law, all of these are acts of assimilation. So then the question becomes, how do we balance the two values, the value that inheres in assimilation and the value that inheres in authenticity, self-expression, human flourishing, you know, on the other hand? And the way in which I try and balance those two is through this reason-forcing conversation. So the reason-forcing conversation goes like this. You know, I ask you to assimilate along a certain axis. So say you are a Muslim woman and you want to wear a veil, and I say, I want you to remove the veil. You say, the mere fact that I can do so is no longer good enough. I want to have a reason-forcing conversation with you, so you as a state have to disgorge a reason for why I have to remove the veil. Some reasons are going to be good reasons, and other reasons are going to be bad reasons, and whether or not my demand that you cover, in this case by ironically uncovering, you know, your veil, is going to depend on how good my reason is. So a good reason for me is a recent case in Florida where the state said, we want you to remove your veil because this is your driver's license and this is our primary form of state identification and we just need to know this. And the opinion was extremely respectful of her religion and went through the burdens that it placed on her religion, but ultimately said, we recognize the harm this does to you, but we have to side with the state in this instance because there is a general interest in having people be knowable on their primary form of state identification. So that's an instance in which the demand to cover would prevail. However, we could imagine the exact same demand not being backed by a sufficiently good reason for the state to be able to prevail. So when we look at cases either in this country, which thank goodness are actually surprisingly relatively rare, of the state requiring this, or if we look in foreign countries, like this is a huge issue in France right now, right, of ostentatious displays of religion being sanctioned such that schoolgirls have to remove their veils, there, the demand is the same, remove your veil. You respond the same way. Well, give me a reason. I want to have the reason-forcing conversation. The mere fact that I can remove the veil isn't enough. You have to have a reason that's legitimate, that's not religious animus, you know, or anything that's a weak reason in order to prevail. There, in this country, the rationale that the school board gave in one of these cases was, well, we just have an interest in uniformity. Like, we want our school children to look the same. But they didn't really have a standardized school uniform. It was just that, you know, so this room could be the school, and then one person could be wearing a veil, and the school was saying, well, you have to remove the veil because we have an interest in uniformity. And that, of course, is, in my view, was not enough. And amazingly, the Department of Justice intervened in that case and agreed that that wasn't enough, and they reached a settlement agreement in which the girl didn't have to remove the veil, so she's still wearing the veil today. So yes, you're right, there are some demands to cover that pass muster even for me, but they're the demands to cover that have survived the reason-forcing conversation.
Good evening. I'm an applied theologian and an ethicist, and I work with, hopefully, eternal laws. And I think to uplift and understand, when you're talking about covering, I always think of the word discover, lack of cover, and basically what we want to uncover is the call of the soul. Given our times, I wonder if you could comment, and maybe Lonnie might also like to comment, on what's happening with the Federalist Society and any linkage with Carl Schmitt. Are you familiar with Carl Schmitt and his tradition
out
of University of Chicago Law School, but also such institutions as the Skull and Bone Society, that we have secret societies that seem to rise to power and authority, such that now you have to think in terms of governance. You think of democracy, you think of plutocracy, you think of autocracy, and that it appears as though we're vulnerable. The soul is always vulnerable to an infiltration of theopathic ism and a lack of reverence for life and so forth. And I wonder if both of you would be willing to comment what you see is happening today with the laws that man makes, and particularly the laws and the nature of law as we're witnessing today in America.
Right. I'm happy to address that. I'm going to say something that I think you'll really like, and then I think I'm going to say something that you'll really hate. So the thing that I think you'll like is that one of the reasons why I advocate this movement from, in response to one of the earlier questions, that the court, well, I didn't actually endorse it, but I do endorse it. I earlier described a movement that the Supreme Court is making away from equality arguments towards liberty arguments. And one of the reasons why I not only want to describe that, but also to normatively endorse that, is because I feel like the movement towards liberty brings us closer to a concept of, you know, what I would call Aristotelian human flourishing, but what somebody who's exactly, or what a human rights advocate might say, fundamental human rights, or what a Amartya Sen might say, fundamental human capability. So you can frame it in either secular terms, or you can frame it in religious terms, but the idea is nonetheless the same, that there's a spark of humanity in each of us that deserves respect, you know, and that the, you know, at the end of their lives, both Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X moved away from civil rights rhetoric to human rights rhetoric on this ground, saying that civil rights was too divisive and group-based, and what we really need to focus on was the spark of humanity that was common to all of us. So that's a bit that I would endorse, and I think that we're on the same page on that one. Now let me say something that I think we're going to disagree on, which is, or we might not, but I'll say it anyway. When you talk about conservatives, or when you talk about Federalists, I actually, when I look at Yale Law School where I teach, my heart really goes out to right-wingers there, because when I think about people who are forced to cover and not be authentic about their beliefs at Yale Law School, which has historically been a bastion of liberalism, it's conservatives and religionists. So people of faith say to me, I feel like I can't come out as a believer, because if I do, my intelligence will immediately go on a 25% discount. You know, like there'll be a sale on my intelligence today, you know, if I come out as a believer. And people who are right-wingers say to me, if I say something that even raises a question about affirmative action or about abortion or any other hot-button issue, there goes my confirmation hearing. So, you know, I won't get confirmed to the federal judiciary, or, I mean, delusions of grandeur, right? But, you know, it's hard to feel sympathetic with people who are living in that kind of a mindset, but stretching our capacities for sympathy, we say, well, that's actually really sad that you feel chilled in that way. And for me, the uncovering project has to hold true just as much for the identities that I myself don't subscribe to as the identities that I endorse. So what I want is an environment in which people are interacting with each other as authentic selves, because while we remain covered, it's very hard for transformation or persuasion in either direction to happen. If you'll, again, allow me a kind of literary digression, there's a Raymond Carver story that I've always loved called Cathedral, about a man who, I see nods in the audience, about a man who's this kind of lout, and he and his wife invite a blind man over for dinner. It's really his wife who does it. And the guy is such a jerk and really doesn't want the blind man in his house, and is really crass and challenging and obnoxious to the blind man. Whereas the wife is really politically correct and gentle and kind. And so initially our sympathies are entirely with the wife, right? Because she is being very polite, and she's not she's covered over any prejudice that she might have about the blind man. But then we start to notice that the wife is infantilizing the blind man. So because the man is so uncomfortable, he pulls out a joint and starts smoking it and passing it around. But the wife is trying to protect the blind man, and the blind man can't see the joint. So the wife keeps taking like double tokes on this joint and then passing it away from the blind man to protect the blind man. And of course, ends up inhaling so much marijuana that she passes out, right? So then the man is forced to confront this blind man on his own. And you think, well, this is going to be a disaster because the buffer is now gone, like the reasonable person has now departed, and you know, we're now, this is like Lord of the Flies or something. But and it starts out really badly because the man just turns on the TV and says, I'm gonna watch TV, you do whatever you want. And then the show is about cathedrals, and the blind man says, what's the show about? You know, the lout says, it's about cathedrals. Well, what does a cathedral look like? Well, I can't really describe it to you. Well, can you draw it for me on this paper bag? And you know, what good's that gonna do if you can't see my drawing? And then the blind man says, well, actually, I can feel the drawing. So if you draw the lines, I will follow your hands with my hands and see the cathedral that way. And so this, I mean, it's a wonderful story. And so it ends with this kind of Carver-esque moment where the blind man and the lout simultaneously are seeing something. The blind man sees a cathedral. And then the lout says at the end of the story, and it felt like I wasn't inside of anything, you know, at that moment. And I think that that moment isn't possible if we all approach each other as covered selves, right? Like the wife, the woman who seems so reasonable and nice, is so politically correct that she never lets whatever prejudices she might have, that she probably does have about blind people, come to the surface. And it's only when we're willing to actually allow our beliefs to really be in play and be on the table that either side can risk transformation. So what I say to my conservative students is, you know, have the courage of your convictions, and I will argue till, you know, we're blue in the face about affirmative action or about abortion, but I can guarantee you that we'll both feel better about the conversation after we've had that conversation, rather than passing each other in the halls and just nodding to each other.
My name is Jenny, and you sort of touched on this already, but I just want to know what you...
I'm sorry.
Could you just speak into the microphone?
Oh, sorry.
I also didn't let you...
No, that's fine.
Okay.
Sorry. I'm just curious as to what you see as the way to facilitate these sorts of conversations, and like what you, if you were going to move it outside the legal realm into the cultural realm, how is that going to be possible? And is the ultimate goal for us, for like a society, a differenceless society, you know, where everyone sort of ignores everyone else's differences? Or, I mean, I guess that's not the goal at all, but like the goal just being to, like how are we going to approach that eventual goal of recognizing everyone's authentic self?
Right. I mean, I think that that goal happens in really intimate settings. So, I mean, Lonnie mentioned before that a lot of the conversations that I had around my gay identity, thank God, I mean, I'm currently, unfortunately, a plaintiff in a lawsuit against the federal government for the government is doing this lovely thing where it says, you know, if you don't allow us to violate your non-discrimination policy on the basis of sexual orientation, will withdraw $300 million of funding from the entire university. So, you know, they're trying to like buy their way in to recruit on campus in violation of our non-discrimination policy. So in that case, I filed suit. And so I do want to emphasize that some of these conversations are legal conversations, right? But as I say in my book, I say, I'm a plaintiff in this suit, but thank God this is the only time when I've actually wanted to sue rather than to have a conversation with a person, because I feel like the conversations are much more fruitful in allowing us a path towards our authentic selves. So Lonnie mentioned a conversation that I was having with my family, and when I think about where I've elaborated my gay identity in a way that makes me feel like authentic and proud of who I am, you know, the department, you know, Donald Rumsfeld is not the person who has helped me towards my authentic gay self, right? You know, that conversation has taken place internal to family, and it's taken place in these really intimate and fine-grained and repeated and painful conversations that I've had with my mother, my father, my sister. And if you talk to anybody who is gay, I think that the primary conversations that they're most terrified of, and which are also most important to them, are those intimate conversations. So when you say, where do these conversations happen? I feel like they happen in family, they happen among friends, they happen in neighborhoods, they happen in classrooms, they happen in water coolers, they happen in the public square. You know, they happen everywhere. Sure.
Jeffrey Nelson. When you speak about the fatigue that our nation is in the midst of in passing out civil rights and so on, it's sort of disheartening in a way.